I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network, and it's time for All Things Political. Donald Trump Jr., campaign chair Paul Manafort, son-in-law Jared Kushner, met with a Russian lawyer 2 weeks after Donald Trump clinched the Republican nomination. He said it was about adoption. First, he said that on Saturday, and then yesterday said it was to get information about Hillary Clinton that the Russian lawyer said that she had. We'll get background on that Russian lawyer and about this meeting. Was it, as Reince Priebus has said, a big nothing burger, or is it problematic for the Trump administration? Congress is back in session this week. Is there a new plan for replacing the Affordable Care Act, or as Mitch McConnell suggested, will the Republicans work with the Democrats to better the ACA? Our guest presents lessons from the 1980s about health care. After the one-on-one meeting with Vladimir Putin, President Trump promised to create a cybersecurity unit with him and then tweeted that no such unit would be possible. Many states are refusing to give voter information to the Election Integrity Commission. Why? The president gives a well-received speech in Warsaw and receives some criticism from world leaders for the U.S. withdrawal from the Paris Accord. A few of the many issues we'll be talking about this hour, and we're happy to have Julian Zelizer with us. He's a political historian at Princeton University, a CNN political analyst, co-host of Politics and Polls, and author of many books, and we've interviewed him for all of those books, The Fierce Urgency of Now, Lyndon Johnson, Congress and the Battle for the Great Society, The Reagan Years, 1981 to 1989, Jimmy Carter, The Politics of National Security from World War II to the War on Terrorism, and we'll be welcoming phone calls for him. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Professor Julian Zelizer, always a pleasure. Hello.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, our great pleasure. Well, let's start with this meeting with Donald Trump Jr., Paul Manafort, and Jared Kushner. The stories keep changing on this, and I'm sure that there are a lot of people who want to hear from all the people about exactly what happened. Give us a little more information on this Russian lawyer. Putin says he doesn't know her, and the Kremlin doesn't know her, which I find hard to believe because she's got all kinds of connections with the Kremlin.
She does, and she was a lawyer who we know was very invested in lobbying against legislation that passed here in 2012, I believe, that essentially blacklisted human rights abusers from Russia. It was put into place after someone who had exposed corruption was killed. And this was something that the Russians were very unhappy about. They had retaliated by stopping an adoption program for Russian children. And she was very active here in the U.S. in trying to overturn that. She's also very connected to other Russian institutions and officials. And initially, Donald Trump Jr. said that the meeting, or the spokesman said that the meeting was about this adoption, this halt of adoption in relation to the law, but now it's emerged that she was said to have dirt, essentially, on Hillary Clinton, and that's why the meeting took place. And Paul Manafort, who was running the campaign for Donald Trump, who had just clinched the nomination for the GOP, and Jared Kushner were also in attendance. So this is not some isolated person. She was someone who was known has many connections that are raising red flags.
Is it unusual, Julian, for a campaign to get dirt on an opponent from a foreign government or a foreign country?
It is. It's not unusual for campaigns to get information about their opposition, to look for dirt. Opposition research is a conventional part of American politics. But doing this with someone connected to another government, a government that is in hostile relations with the United States, is very unusual.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why you hear many legislators today raising concerns about this.
What's also unusual is Donald Trump Jr.'s many different comments, and they're very conflicting comments about whether or not he met with the Russian, and first denied that anybody set up any meeting some months ago, and then it was about adoption, and then yesterday it's about Hillary Clinton. It goes all over the place, and he doesn't seem to serve himself very well with yesterday's announcement, does he?
No, he doesn't, and this has been an ongoing problem for the administration. We've seen many instances, including with people like Mike Flynn, where information was not revealed or information comes out later about contacts with Russian officials. And this continues to be a reason that so many members of Congress have been suspicious and believe there's a need for some kind of investigation. This was in some ways more egregious in that here you have the son of the president, someone who was very high up in the campaign, giving very different statements within the span of a few hours about why this meeting took place. And so it's hard to simply dismiss this if you're a member of the administration as irrelevant, especially when we're hearing very different explanations of what was going on. And one of those explanations comes back to connections between the campaign and Russians.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're not doing themselves a favor by explaining it this way or handling the matter this way.
It has been suggested that it could be treason for an American to knowingly receive and use information obtained by a foreign adversary through spying in the United States. Would you agree with that or not?
Well, I'm not a lawyer, and I've heard this, and it certainly seems we've heard this from plausible people. The official who said that, I believe, was a lawyer who's worked in Republican administration.
Absolutely, it was.
Right, and so, you know, I think we're in one of those spaces where that's certainly a plausible claim and a claim that will receive more attention. And so part of this will obviously involve the lawyer and what exactly her connections and her intentions were. But, you know, here you have a campaign for a U.S. president connected to this official meeting by the admission of Donald Trump Jr. himself over campaign-related material. And this is a month before the WikiLeaks. So there are a lot of dots that people are starting to connect. That doesn't mean there's treason. It doesn't mean there's collusion. But more than any other story we have seen, I'd say, thus far, this brings the two sides together in some concrete moment that members of the administration are now admitting took place.
Do you know, Julian, what the status is of the Mueller investigation and also who he has working with him?
Well, we don't know what the status is, and as it should be, it's been pretty closed, and I don't think we'll know when he's going to finish or where he is until he releases some kind of report. He's brought together some very talented lawyers from within the administration and outside the administration who, by all accounts, are very good, solid people. And we don't really know much more. I think everything else about what he's doing would just be pure speculation.
The meeting between the President of the United States and the President of Russia took place, been receiving a lot of attention. These words that, and now he's changed what he said about this, but his declaration that we can partner with Vladimir Putin on a cybersecurity unit, prompting this response from Marco Rubio, partnering with Putin on a cybersecurity unit is akin to partnering with Assad on a chemical weapons unit. He said that on Twitter, and then the president changed his tune with another tweet saying that he didn't really think that would be possible. What's going on here?
Well, it was surprising to hear him and hear Secretary Tillerson talk about this after that meeting took place. The meeting itself is highly controversial because it elevated Putin in a way that the Russians have been looking to achieve without any concrete kind of payoff from this. But the idea of, in the middle of these ongoing revelations about how Russia not only intervened in the 2016 election, but is still trying to hack into various U.S. systems, is planning, similar attacks elsewhere in the world, even within the U.S. All these stories are out there, and there's a lot of evidence that this is a very serious operation. The idea of mounting a cybersecurity program in partnership with the person we need or the entity we need to protect ourselves against doesn't seem very sound. And so someone obviously told this to the president because, you know, he often stands firm when he says something like this, and this was a very quick turnaround.
Is anybody going to release a transcript with the Russians? I guess we wouldn't, but would the Russians release a transcript of what was said in that two-hour meeting?
Well, they might. There weren't many people in the room, but you remember when the meeting took place here in Washington with the Russians and the president, and notes were released after that that revealed the president had shared classified information. I don't know if anything like that would happen again. I mean, this was why it was so contained. But look, at this point, maybe one of the three might leak something. And certainly the Russians and Putin really thrive on this kind of information release and creating instability through contradictions and contradictory stories. And so it wouldn't be a total shock if they had an interest in either undercutting the president or creating confusion through their own account of what happened.
I guess confusion abounds these days, doesn't it?
It does, and this is one of the dangers of certainly of dealing with the Russian government, because this is what they thrive on. So when you enter into these meetings, this is what you're going to get. It's not really a surprise. It's been going on over the course of many years, and several presidents have experienced this. But here within our own country, I think many citizens are feeling kind of a similar sense of instability about what's true and what's not true. And part of that is a result of the multiple contradictory statements that come from the administration. It's hard to take any single statement and claim that's the position of the administration, because on almost any issue, there's so many contradictions, you just don't know where the president stands.
Mm-hmm. What do you know about this ceasefire in parts of Syria, which Donald Trump has said will save lives? Was this a significant piece of an agreement between the two nations?
Well, there initially, clearly, there was enthusiasm when Secretary Tillerson announced it. It was initially seen as, here is evidence that maybe the president is actually trying to achieve something through a sort of detente with the Russians. But it's very limited. I mean, the first thing to remember is we've had ceasefires before, and they've broken down. President Obama had put two into place, and neither worked. The Syrian government wasn't really interested in upholding them, and certainly Putin wasn't either. And this is a very limited ceasefire. It's a ceasefire in part of the region where the war is not quite as intense as in the others. So it's a small step. It's not insignificant, nor should it be dismissed. Obviously, any effort to achieve peace and stability in that region, which has become explosive, is good. But I think it would probably be a mistake to overblow it and say this was a major development that is a signal that we're on our way to a different trajectory in Syria.
On to the issue that's probably number one among most Americans, and that is there a health care plan? Congress returning today from their July 4th break. And you also wrote a piece I want you to talk about, some that there are lessons from the 1980s we should remember about health care. What is the story right now? Is there going to be some agreement with or working with Democrats to tweak the Obamacare, or is there a health care plan that the Republicans do have? What's the story?
The Republicans have a health plan. It's just not one that looks like it can pass the Senate. Mm-hmm. They went into their break without the votes that they needed, and Senator McConnell didn't clearly have any kind of strategy to get those votes. Things seem to have gotten worse over the break. Senators heard from protesters, not just moderates, but even conservatives, and many have said they're backing away or they're not going to vote for this bill. So we don't know what Senator McConnell is cooking up. He's trying to work with people like Senator Cruz of Texas to try to put together a coalition. But right now, they don't have it. And they don't have a lot of flexibility because in the House, the Freedom Caucus is not going to move very far from the legislation that they were able to achieve. And so it's in peril. And here we are in July, and the major legislative move by the Republicans is falling apart. Senator McConnell said in a threat, basically, to Republicans that the alternative will be to work with Democrats on fixing ACA rather than repealing and replace it. And while it's a threat, I don't think it's totally impossible, given how poorly they have performed, and they do not want premiums to go up as Democrats don't. So this is one area where I think some of this talk, there might be something to it. But obviously, the preference and the incentives are all for the Republicans to pass a Republican bill.
What are the lessons we should remember about health care in the 1980s?
Well, I wrote a piece about Social Security reform in 1983, which was really interesting. Early on, President Reagan in 81 and 82 tries to implement these cuts in Social Security, and he faces a terrible backlash. The Democrats just go after him. He backs away from touching what's called the third rail in American politics. But in 83, he and the Republicans work with Democrats to fix the Social Security system, which is facing a financial shortfall. And they have a commission put into place, and Senator Bob Dole, who leads the Republicans in the Senate, works with Patrick Moynihan, a New York senator, and several other members, and they pass really an important piece of legislation in 83 when everyone at the time said it's impossible. The parties will never get along on doing this. And it was really important to shoring up the strength of the program. So I kind of told that story as maybe there's a possibility for some of what Senator McConnell is talking about to actually happen as Republicans deal with the fallout from this really mess of a bill that they have tried to push through.
Professor Julian Zelizer is our guest for All Things Political this hour. He's a political historian at Princeton University, CNN political analyst, co-host of Politics and Polls, and author of a number of books, including presidential history books. We welcome your phone calls. What do you make of this meeting that was called by Donald Trump? Somebody approached him who was involved with the Miss Universe pageant in Moscow, saying that he should meet with this Russian lawyer. And we found out yesterday that it was supposedly because the lawyer had some dirt on Hillary Clinton. So Paul Manafort, Jared Kushner, and Donald Trump Jr. met with this lawyer and said that, you know, nothing really happened. They didn't get any information. But this was after he said the meeting was about adoption and after that he said some months ago that he never attended a meeting that was set up by anybody to meet with Russians. Do you think that this is problematic, or is it a big nothing burger, as Ryan Priebus said? I know that health care is front and center on many of your minds because there is some question about what the Republicans will do. Will there be a bill that is met with more satisfaction among Americans than the one that was put together and didn't go anywhere because there weren't enough votes? And it would appear there still aren't enough votes. What do you think about that? We want to talk about states refusing to give voter information to the Election Integrity Commission. It seems to me as though that commission is just not going to be able to do what they wanted to do because it's illegal in many states to turn over some of this very personal information. So will they continue with that? We will talk about that. The G20, we can discuss that. The meeting, of course, between President Trump and President Putin. What do you think about that? Working together in cybersecurity? Really? And then, well, maybe that won't work out, was the latest message. What do you think? Here's our phone number, and we would love to hear from you. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network. All Things Political this hour. Welcome to your phone calls for Julian Zelizer, one of our favorite guests on this show. Our number is 800 486 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we have some lines open for you right now. Professor Zelizer, what about the G20 meeting? What did you pick up on the vibes that we were getting to from other world leaders to our administration, the concern about the U.S. withdrawing from the Paris Accord? Did you sense that things were a little adrift?
They are. Adrift is probably a light word to use. There's immense tension between the U.S. and most of the other leaders, and there are clear points of disagreement. Clearly, President Trump's position on climate change did not sit well with the other leaders in the room, and Merkel was very clear about this. She didn't really hide her feelings very much. There's disagreements over trade, which is not a surprise, but the other leaders are not comfortable with some of the steps that President Trump is taking, and clearly there's a lot of discomfort with the welcome reception that he had for Putin, including the fact that that meeting dominated the summit, which is probably not what a lot of people would have expected just a few months ago. So we are at a moment where the U.S. is probably more isolated within that summit, or the U.S. president is more isolated than it's been in a long time. And that can cause many problems, not simply politically here within the United States, but on moving forward with changes in dealing with the climate.
Eugene Viola.
Yep.
Hi, Eugene.
Hello, Kathleen.
Hi.
Good afternoon to you and your guest. My question is, if one of the investigating committees issues Trump a subpoena and Trump just refuses to acknowledge it or refuses to honor it and ignores it, what then?
That's good. That brings back some memories of the Nixon years, in terms of these confrontations between the branches of government. It would probably be settled in the courts. I think that Trump's attorney, Michael Cohen, has talked a little bit about this, and some other officials indicating that, you know, the president isn't going to testify. But look, if you look at the 1990s, you'll remember President Clinton testifying during the Whitewater investigation, which bled into the Monica Lewinsky investigation. We had President Reagan testifying during Iran-Contra. So it's happened before. But my guess is this administration would fight it tooth and nail, and they would not be very open to doing this. I mean, this is a president who has questioned the legitimacy of the investigation repeatedly, so it's hard to see him saying, I'm happy to come and speak in front of you.
What's going on with the Senate and the House investigations? It seems as though they don't meet very often, or there aren't a whole lot of people testifying. We see a few, and then weeks go by, and nothing seems to be happening. Is it?
Yeah, I think it slowed down. I mean, obviously, the high point came with James Comey during his testimony, and then we really haven't heard much. The committees say they're still investigating, certainly the Senate committee. I think part of this is once you had a special counsel launching its own investigation, Congress became a little more reticent and is allowing that other investigation to continue. But this certainly hasn't turned into the Watergate hearings, meaning Congress, the Senate committee, or the House committee have not used this as a platform to really air out what's going on. They're doing more behind-the-scenes work, or we think, at this point.
Thank you very much, Eugene, for your call. We go to Boyd in St. Francis. Hey, Boyd.
Hi, Kathleen, and hello to your guest. I want to just briefly mention some things about health care. There was a state senator in Wisconsin that did propose a Badger Care for All system, and I think in some ways it's similar to the Medicare for All that Bernie Sanders has proposed. And just a couple questions. Is there ever going to be any chance in the near future, and I'm pretty much realistically talking 20 to 30 years, we'll have a universal system? And what really frustrates me is people always first ask, how do you pay for it? it's really just a shift of priorities, and then it would be through taxes. But when you know how basic insurance is set up, it's 6 to 8%, or anywhere as low as 4 to 6%. Everyone dips in, including people who have private insurance, and they actually benefit from this because it'll keep their costs under control. And then in terms of funding for hospitals, well, they can look to other models. The British have, their hospitals are state-funded, but in France, that's actually a good system where they have private hospitals, but they receive public funding. It just really frustrates me that, you know, it's there if you bother to look, and our own politicians just want to live in their own little bubble.
Well, the other two pieces of evidence that you could have something like this come from within the U.S., and obviously Medicare is a system where the U.S. government became the insurer, the first insurer, paid for through taxes for elderly Americans, and Medicaid, which it's turning out is very popular in red and blue states, is yet another system. Obviously, it's not universal. It's targeted towards certain constituencies, but it turns out it's much more popular than people thought. There are some people who argue that the irony of all of this could be that the Republican efforts simply collapse and there's more support for what people call Medicare for All. Bernie Sanders has certainly talked about this, expanding our existing insurance programs. We're still a far way away from that. We should remember every time a national system like this has been proposed since Harry Truman, it's come down and been defeated. Healthcare industry is usually against that, even though they're okay with Medicare and Medicaid after the fact. And obviously, many conservatives would certainly not support it. But there's something to be said that some of the effects of this battle over repealing and replacing ACA might lend stronger support for some system that has more of a robust role for government. Senator McConnell's now, when he talks about bipartisanship, he's talking about federal subsidies to shore up these health insurance exchanges. So you can see how it can move the direction of the debate in a more liberal way, ironically enough.
That is pretty ironic. God knows we have been debating this issue, as you well know, for so many years. Think of all the years we debated it to get the Affordable Care Act. Then we had that for a while, and people weren't happy with parts of it, so we debated that. The Republicans talked about repealing it and replacing it. Now they don't have a plan, and on it goes. And meanwhile, legitimately, a lot of Americans are very worried about this because it affects all of us.
They are, and obviously the more the system is unstable, the more that many of the key players, including these insurance companies, become leery about staying in it. And
right.
That is one of the principal arguments, that the reason ACA is not working as well as it could isn't just because of something inherent in the program. It's because the program has been subject to constant delay and obstruction since it was put on the books. And that's one of the problems. But, you know, the issue is controversial because it matters so much to every American. No one is free from the fears that come with health and the need for health care. And that's why every time we deal with this issue, whether we are expanding federal health care programs or, as in the case today, trying to contract them, it's not easy to do, and everyone feels they have a stake in the status quo and will often fight change tooth and nail.
Thank you, Boy. Good to hear from you again. Tammy in Reedsburg. Hi, Tammy.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is about the election. However, I would like to, on the record, give my support to single-payer health care.
All right.
But regarding President Trump and his proposal to create a cybersecurity unit with Russia, I am wondering where Congress is. I am wondering why they are not being our voice. What we have is a president who has accused voters of fraud, put the blame on us, and has basically neglected any kind of election integrity, which there was, you know, questionable election integrity throughout the entire process. That has been completely overlooked. And then suddenly he's decided that maybe election integrity is something that he wants to work on with Russia, of all countries, who have had serious issues with their own election integrity and the integrity of democracy in that nation. I want to know where we are with our Congress and why they are not defending our democracy more vehemently. And it just seems so terrifying for me as a citizen to, you know, have it joked about by Congress that, well, yeah, the president suggested the cybersecurity unit, but that's a bad idea. You know, not the worst I've ever heard, but it's a bad idea.
Right.
And that to me seems absurd.
Well, I'd say there has been pushback to the cybersecurity. I think many Republicans are certainly not very happy with the administration's overall posture toward Russia. Republicans have been incredibly hawkish over the years, most of them, about Russia. So this has been a departure of this administration, and they pushed for this legislation to make sure that sanctions continue to limit what the president can achieve almost unanimously in the Senate. And my guess is some of the pushback from about cybersecurity with the Russians right now came from Republicans, not simply Democrats. So on that issue, they've not been as quiet as they have on other questions. I think the voter integrity, voter fraud is a different issue, but it's very troubling, I think, certainly to many Democrats. There is no evidence of massive voter fraud. It's simply not been confirmed by any reputable source. And yet here the administration has set up this commission chaired by someone who has been very hostile to voting rights and a supporter of the voter restriction laws that many states have put into effect. And they're looking for, they're asking for these records that states don't want to give, asking for, all kinds of data to look for this corruption. And I think this is very frightening to a lot of political observers, because this is part of an ongoing effort that started decades ago and has been an effort to reverse the legacy of the 1960s, meaning voting rights and the protection of voting rights. And it's often been driven by Republican operatives seeking to limit Democratic voting. And so I don't know how the Republican Congress will react to this. This is somewhere they might be more supportive than they are with this cybersecurity proposal.
It almost seems to me, Julian, that commission is going to fall apart, because not only are many states on ethical grounds not wanting to give information, but they also legally can't give that information. Their states have constitutions and laws, and they deal with their own voting situation. It seems to me as though it makes it almost impossible for that commission to continue.
Yeah, it's funny. In this case, President Trump seems to have gone a bit too far. I mean, there's a handful of themes he's very consistent on. One is attacking the fake news, and a second has been voter fraud. And the irony is that within the states, within conservative states, there's been a lot of momentum to impose these very controversial voter restriction laws. But what the president has now done is, in some ways, he's federalized this effort, and he's asking the states to hand over all this information that's causing both consternation and legal problems. Not simply from very liberal states where you'd suspect they'd say no to the president, but conservative officials in Republican states mm-hmm. have also said this is not going to happen. So he might undercut some of his own effort here by putting the responsibility and putting the focus on a federal commission, as opposed to letting conservative states continue with what they've been doing for a while.
An email from Lori from St. Francis. Is it possible that President Trump didn't know about Donald Trump's meeting with the Russian lawyer?
It is possible. And here we have a president who really didn't have much experience and seems to run a very chaotic kind of political operation, as he did in the world of business and the world of entertainment. And so we shouldn't assume he knows everything that was going on, but it becomes harder to believe each time we hear a new story. And now that we're hearing a story about his son, I think, you know, many people will find it less plausible that he had no sense any of this was going on. And even if he didn't, it's still pretty problematic, meaning if all these high-level officials really were not only in contact with the Russians, but maybe now actually working on getting information or giving information, you know, in some ways, whether he knew about each meeting or not, won't be the biggest story. It's really about how the Republican campaign conducted itself in relation to a foreign power that was intervening in the election. But we should not assume that he knew about it. And I think we'd ask that of any president, Democratic or Republican. There needs to be evidence that he did before we say that.
Zach in Waupaca. Hi, Zach.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So healthcare is so complicated with insurance and pharmaceuticals and other industries involved. But the thing that's most frustrating is that everybody's paralyzed with just argument and not able to agree on anything. And there are certain things that nobody would disagree with. We have a serious workforce shortage of primary care physicians, psychiatrists, general surgeons, and it hits our rural areas harder than it hits anywhere else. And the baby boomer generation is going to need more health care, which we're already seeing. But more importantly, there's a whole generation of baby boomer doctors that are just about ready to retire. And most critical access hospitals are just barely getting by with enough staff to be able to keep their doors open and offer all the 24-hour services that they do. The longer we sit in a paralyzed state of can't agree on what direction to go, the more of a crisis this is really going to become.
That's true. I mean, some would say that sounds like the climate, meaning there are very real problems that we know about. There are problems that are felt, unlike with the climate. You could argue that they're felt more immediately and more directly when you talk about health care. But our political process is not conducive to quick changes and to solving these kinds of problems. When Medicare was passed in 65, we also had acute problems. Many elderly Americans, most elderly Americans, didn't have adequate health care, and that was nothing new. That had been going on for years. There were stories about this. There were stories about families who couldn't afford their own lives because they were paying for their parents or grandparents, yet nothing was done because the gridlock over Medicare doesn't break until 1965. And that's where we are today, but that is also making it harder simply to dismantle the system that we have, because many legislators in the Republican Party are learning that even if the system is imperfect and it's fragile and it's problematic, the benefits that we do have are really vital, and people don't want less, they want more right now.
Julian Zelizer is our guest, and it's All Things Political you're listening to this hour. He is a prolific author and opinion writer. He's on television and radio a lot, doing stellar political analysis. He's a political historian at Princeton University, and you see him frequently on CNN. He writes an opinion column for CNN as well, co-host of Politics and Polls, and author of a number of books, The Fierce Urgency of Now, Lyndon Johnson, Congress, and the Battle for the Great Society. Another one on the Reagan years from 1981 to 1989, and many other books. We have one line open if you'd like to join us. The number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Twitter is at K Dunn Show. Professor Zelizer writes recently that the president's speech in Warsaw sounded the right notes on several fronts. We will talk about that speech and how it clashed with what the professor calls less reasonable aspects of his news conference. All of that is coming up on the Ideas Network. Let's talk a little bit about the president's speech in Warsaw. It was highly lauded. You have said that it sounded the right notes on several fronts, Julian, but it clashed with the less reasonable aspects of his news conference.
Yeah, I mean, whether many people disagree with the substance of what he said, but as a speech, it was more polished than most of the speeches that he gave. It gave a worldview, you know, this battle between the West and What he is saying is radical Islamic terrorism. And again, many people don't agree with that, but it's a worldview. He said he would support Article 5 of NATO. He offered words of criticism about what Russia has been doing to create instability in different places of the world. So as a speech, it was clearly one of his better moments. But it totally contradicts so many things that came before and after. And again, the press conference before the speech, he refused to take a real tough line with regards to what the Russians had done with our own election and really questioned whether that was the story. And then after the speech, as we now know, there's been so many statements and problematic positions that he's taken that speech fades away. So it's a constant story with this administration that even the few moments where you can say, well, here he is being more politically skillful and seems to have the ability to deliver an address like this, it quickly falls apart, and it doesn't really stand up because of the many other things that he said on issues like NATO and Russia that have nothing to do with the message of the speech.
I'm sure what Ronald Reagan said to Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall, I've thought about that. Maybe you wrote about it, in an analysis of how different presidents have dealt with the Russians. What a contrast, wasn't it?
It was, and Reagan, when he delivered that in 1987, was in the middle of these negotiations with Mikhail Gorbachev, where he was doing controversial things for his own party. He was negotiating with the communists who he said could never be trusted, and yet he was doing that. But he delivered that address as a way to send a signal to the Soviets that he was still the tough, cold warrior, and to send a signal back to the conservatives here in the U.S. that he wasn't going to be reckless in the negotiations. But it resonated. It really stuck as a good speech and a speech that he meant, in part because of who he had been his whole career and because of the consistency of message. And that doesn't exist with President Trump. Mm-hmm. And so it makes it harder for this kind of speech to have that same effect.
So we're not that far away from these midterm elections, and I want to know what's being done, because we know the Russians did all kinds of things, hacking into our elections, trying to change voter rolls and everything. They're doing things with businesses now related to nuclear power. What assurances do we have, and what programs have we put in place to keep them from having a huge impact on our midterm elections?
Well, that's a great question, and I don't know the answer to that. All we've really learned in the public sphere is all the vulnerabilities that we face. We now see the Russians have conducted this through disinformation on social media, which is difficult for the government to really control within the U.S. so much as combat. We've learned they've tried to hack into state election systems, which will really be incumbent on the states with federal support to make sure there's no vulnerabilities when people go to vote. And people are skeptical or uncertain about what this administration is doing because the president is not confident that intelligence agencies are correct, that there was a problem to begin with. And so we don't know, and I think that is very unsettling and a reason that people are so upset with what happened. It's not simply about President Trump or his legitimacy. It's about the vitality of our electoral system.
Paul in Grays Lake, hi.
Hi, thank you. I'm afraid I'm going to take it back to healthcare.
That's fine.
I guess I'll add briefly first that a decade ago, I was in a corporate job that touched on computer security issues. Back then, we'd look and say, oh, good grief. And there are people, there are experts in the field that know a significant amount of what needs to be done. And often, it's more of a fight with management than actually doing the work. So that's a big part of the problem, is that the people who actually control what's being done still don't really understand, and often have other concerns, cost, and other factors ahead of actual security. Mm-hmm. But as for healthcare, What I wanted to mention are two things briefly. One, two things that don't get mentioned enough. So one is that any law has two parts, the law itself and paying for it. And with the Affordable Care Act, one of the things that happened is that it had a provision because insurers wouldn't know initially what the new pools were going to be, what the risk was going to be, for a couple of years to make them whole. If they miscalculated, to provide funds to make up the difference. That was in the original law that was passed by Congress, both sides. When it came time to actually make those payments, the Republican-controlled Congress at that point refused to include those payments in the budget. And the numbers I've heard vary a bit, anywhere from 14% to 17%. 14 to 17 cents on the dollar were paid for those losses that were guaranteed by the law to be made whole. The other concern is that this ACA has been portrayed so much as a left, liberal, whatever program. People should remember that back when it was being debated and passed, and in a couple of years prior, businesses were screaming bloody murder about double-digit price increases for health care insurance year over year over year, and they were saying, we can't compete on the international stage if our costs keep up going up to this degree as opposed to our competitors overseas. So I viewed the ACA as a very middle-of-the-road program. You know, it was something that people could find compromise on across the aisle.
All right, and you did move on to another caller, but let's get a response. Julian.
Yeah, I mean, there's what it does, the program, there's paying for it, and there's implementing it. That's the third part. And what the caller is talking about is a lot of this has never really been implemented. And so the Republican Congress has been able to block a lot of these key payments and provisions. The mandate hasn't really been enforced. And so the program isn't sustainable. But again, it's not just the design of the program. It's we're not even allowing it to work to begin with. And it is a middle-of-the-road program. President Obama knew that. He picked up on Governor, then-Governor Mitt Romney's health care plan in Massachusetts, and that was the idea to sell a conservative plan as a way to undercut Republican opposition. But in American politics, opponents can turn anything into anything. And Republicans turned what was a middle-of-the-road program, as they did with President Clinton, who was unsuccessful, into what they saw as a radical left-wing program. It's really a cost containment program. This is far away from the kind of national insurance that people like Ted Kennedy were fighting for in the 1970s. This is an effort to reduce premiums, create some kind of regulatory order, and ensure stable markets. But look, politics has really shifted. And Republicans were very successful at framing the issue in a way that Democrats were not.
We have less than a minute left, but Nate, get your comment out there at least. Hi.
Hi, thanks for having me. I was going to go back to the election commission Trump was putting together and saying they maybe ought to look at the real rigging of elections at state level through gerrymandering. I know we have the Whitford versus Gill case from Wisconsin, where you've got one party getting most of the votes, the other one gets a majority in the state legislature, and a lack of bouncing it back and forth between parties like we used to have.
Yeah, that's going to be a big case. Any sense of where that might go, Julian?
Huge. Yeah, I mean, huge case. I can't guess what the courts are going to do, but there is a lot of support now for new standards in creating districts that are mathematically based rather than politically based. And there has been growing support in key states like California to create nonpartisan commissions to use these formulas. And I agree. I think this could be one of the real landmark moments in trying to reform our elections, but not in the way everyone's taught. It's not just cybersecurity or quote-unquote voter fraud. It's in the very real problem of partisan gerrymandering.
Yeah. Julian Zelizer, thank you so much. I'm going to be retiring in mid-August, so this is probably the last time we'll have a chance to talk, but I wanted to just tell you how deeply I've appreciated all of your appearances and all of your knowledge, and you're just such a great speaker as well. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure to have these conversations, and good luck.
Thank you. Julian Zelizer, political historian at Princeton University, CNN political analyst, co-host of Politics and Polls, and he has written a number of books. We've interviewed him for almost, well, not almost, for each and every one of them. Thanks to Colleen Leahy for producing this hour, and to Colleen as well for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. Thanks for all of your interesting calls. We're going to talk about mental health, hour two.